Good morning, everybody. I would like to welcome you to this second day of the structured dialogue on possible arrangements for a facilitation mechanism or to promote the development, transfer, and dissemination of clean and environmentally sound technologies. And after a very interactive discussion we had yesterday, we shall now begin with the morning segment of the structured dialogue 2, focusing on the question, how much fragmentation is there? How much of it represents gaps? How much of it is duplication? And how much of it is lack of information on what exists? Once again, I would like to invite you, as you did yesterday, to set aside your prepared text and to interact with the panel and with the rest of the participants. Before, however, we enter into the discussion, we will hear panelists, and afterwards the floor will be opened for comments, observations, and questions. As yesterday, I'm privileged to be surrounded by three eminent panelists, and I already now thank them for their participation and coming to New York for the purpose. First, here to my immediate right is Mr. Jukka Uosakainen, Director of the Climate Technology Center and Network. On my left, I have Mr. Xiong Zhang, Senior Program Coordinator of the Clean Technology Fund and Scaling Up Renewable Energy Program at the World Bank. And last but not least, once again to my right here, Mr. Jose Zaglul, President of Earth University in Costa Rica. I would first now give the floor to Mr. Uosakainen for his presentation. I understand he has prepared a PowerPoint presentation, so the floor is yours. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chairman, and let me express my gratitude that I have been invited here in the United Nations General Assembly to tell you about the story about the technology cooperation, technology center under the climate regime. I took this post only a couple of months ago. I'm a former government officer. I have been here many, many years negotiating sustainable development on behalf of my government, and I'm happy to come back here now as an officer for the United Nations. Let me first touch one question which was put in front of the panel. That is about that: is there fragmentation? Is there too much fragmentation? What does that entail? And definitely, let me assure that indeed. There is much fragmentation on the development and transfer of technologies for sustainable development. Of course, it is for the reason. Technology is introduced and transferred almost in any single project in the world, be it public or private, or whether commercial or non-commercial. All kinds of development without applying suitable, appropriate technologies is impossible. And on the other hand, technology as such is always only a part of a development process. And indeed, like Secretary General's report states, that for the successful technology journey, we need also both private companies, we need finance, we need markets and enabling policies. Now, it would be indeed very interesting and but also a very challenging task to define some kind of single body providing or managing technologies for all the needs and sectors for sustainable development. Having said so, I of course totally agree with the sentiments that there is not clearly enough concerted efforts to overcome technology barriers, particularly related to challenges in developing countries. And therefore, we have agreed in many international agreements, such as the Climate Convention, that we will give an extra attention to support the development and transfer of technologies. And this has been quite a long negotiation journey when we have ended up what we are today. If you... Yes, the next. And I will bring you a bit of that history. We have negotiated technology transfer more than 13 years, starting early 20s in Marrakesh. And it was only at 2009 when the heads of states convened in Copenhagen in the climate conference that they politically promised that we will establish a technology mechanism under the United Nations framework for climate change. And that mechanism consisted of two particular bodies. One was the Technology Executive Committee, which is meant to guide us and give strategic guidance to parties and bodies. And then the other one was operative element, and that was the Technology Center and Network, which now I am leading. This political agreement was then endorsed by all the parties in Cancun in Mexico 2010, when the parties decided that to establish this mechanism. And when deciding that, the parties also decided that the Executive Committee of Technology shall seek cooperation with all relevant international technology initiatives, stakeholders and organizations, and promote coherence and cooperation across technology activities, including activities under and outside of the convention. And then for the Technology Center and Network, they decided that it will stimulate and encourage, through collaboration with the private sector, public institutions, academia and research institutions, the development and transfer of existing and emerging environmentally sound technologies, as well as opportunities for north-south, south-south and triangular technology cooperation. So here you see that indeed there was a very strong will and actually common understanding that technology cooperation should be enhanced. And these decisions that led into this situation where we are now, and here you see what the CTC and is delivering. So this is an operational arm of the technology mechanism under the convention, and it mainly requests the substantive technical answers and responses to the technical requests coming from developing countries. So that is our main purpose, our core services. We are there for developing countries, but they have to put a request to us in order that we know what is their most burning technological issue on climate. And when we get that question, that request, we will act immediately. And that means that we will respond to that kind of question or request and will help the developing country to develop a solution to the technological problem, usually that being some kind of plan or mature proposal for financing for the other financial bodies of the convention or outside of it. We of course also provide maybe the big bank here. We also provide for technical assistance in participating and organizing events in the countries and in the region. And we will also are going to establish very extensive web-based help desk and other information services. It's important to notice that this core center under the UNFCCC as a little body, it's only less than 10 people working in Copenhagen. It's situated in the Nguyen City in Copenhagen, and it has been provided by the Danish government. We have got also very, very substantive contributions by some governments. The whole center is working and running for the based on the bilateral support from the governments of Norway and United States, Japan, Canada, as well as the European Commission. And we are happy to be able to secure some $20-25 million of running capital to help the developing countries in their requests. The system is such that we have a consortium of 13 international institutions, and they are led by United Nations Environment Programme and United Nations Industrial Development Organization. Now, these are the institutions who are, and this you see the map here, are meant to be dealing firstly with these requests coming from developing countries. They are located all around the world, and they are covering most of the themes of the climate areas, being them mitigation or adaptation. And that means that we are kind of prepared to be quickly responsive to any kind of question, whether it is coming from the mitigation side, like dealing with renewable energy policies or energy efficiency standards or regulations, or whether it will be from the adaptation, which very often is the case with the least developed countries in the world, dealing with agricultural resistant crops, or can you put it back a bit, or water management, or some other issues most important priorities which that developing country has seen. This maybe answers some of the question of when we talk about are there gaps and are there priorities, are there overlaps, and so on. Within this technological center and its network, we try to strongly coordinate our responses to developing countries in such a way that we use the best skills and expertise what we found. First of all, we have a regional... Can you still keep it? We have a regional representation. That means that when the request comes from, for example, Latin America, like nowadays many requests has come, we engage those institutions which are working in Latin America for Latin American countries. And the same applies, of course, with Africa and Asia. But then we also call upon those institutions in the consortium which have got specific knowledge on that theme which the developing countries ask. So that's why we try to bring a kind of collaborative effort and avoid overlaps in our work. Here you see that also we are now starting to expand a network beyond that consortium. We are expecting that hundreds of climate technology-related institutions, companies, corporations, and partnership will join us in order to indeed work with the developing countries on these issues. The first six institutions and companies have applied to be partners of our network, and we have accepted them. So you see there also that, interestingly, World Intellectual Property Organization, WIPO, has also come as a partner. And that means then that when that kind of question which is dealing with intellectual properties are coming to us from some countries, we maybe turn and use the expertise and of that organization, as they have volunteered to be one of us. I think that's important thing to kind of understand, that this technology network idea was very much strongly emphasized by the parties, and they didn't want to have one single office somewhere in the world to be able to respond to all the kind of questions under climate technologies, but using a large network which is covering the whole world. What is important to note is that this is very much bottom-up. This was already decided by the heads of state in Copenhagen and also confirmed by the parties in Cancun that under climate, the technology services are given based on the country's own requests. And that's why we are only working based on the nationally designated entities which the government are nominating. These are the ones who are entitled to ask us help, and we are then giving that. Already over 75 NDEs have been nominated, and they are already submitting us these requests. At the moment, if you... No problem. At the moment, we have started to receive these requests. That this has happened only last weeks, maybe for a month now. And some frontline developing countries have submitted those. The requests indeed have been very interesting. Some of them have been dealing with biodiversity monitoring or following the adaptation indicators. Some of them have been dealing with the policies for renewable energies and energy efficiencies and their analysis, how they are really giving a value added for the government in their efforts. Also, we have got a request dealing with sustainable agriculture and even planning public transportation systems in such a way that we avoid climate emissions. So they are coming from all over in the range of technological continuum, whether they are research and development or deployment and dissemination, and they come from both adaptation and from mitigation. I'm very happy that countries have activated themselves, and I'm urging all the countries to nominate their national designated entities as well as then submitting their requests to us so that we can start working with them. I think that start has been very good. May I, in this context, touch the one question, which was that do we know enough about the real issues on what are the real gaps on technology transfer and development under sustainable development regime, and of course I refer to climate. Now, 80 developing countries have actually also carried out their specific technology need assessment procedures. These have been now been carried out for 10 years, and it has been supported, the whole process has been supported by Global Environmental Facility and other financial institutions and been carried out by UN agencies and others. Now, we have analyzed these results of these technology needs assessments, and we have found that indeed there are some overall general conclusions to be made. One is that what comes to the mitigation, energy efficiencies and renewable energies are definitely the priority sectors which the developing countries considered important. On the adaptation side, it is indeed, and logically, agriculture and water management. When we then ask them that what are the main barriers to technology transfer and development, main challenges, it came up from both of the regimes, both adaptation and mitigation, that indeed economical and financial challenges are the most important ones, and the second were the policy and regulatory challenges. So indeed, if we want to analyze that where we should focus our efforts to work with developing countries, we might take a note on that work which has been done under the Technology Executive Committee of the Climate Safe Convention. It might be applicable to the others. When we turn to the information, lack of information indeed, and even we can say lack of information on the other hand, and on the other hand, huge amount of information where the developing country officer and authority can't just get through that where is the right information for their purposes, for their needs. Now, CTCN is establishing a knowledge management system where we try to answer to that gap and that need. We are trying to establish such a technical assistance within that knowledge management system where we serve the countries with multilingual approach, looking at sectoral focuses and regional focuses, and that we include capacity building and try to be as friendly as possible for the customers. Having said so, we are stating here, and I'm stating very strongly, that we are not going to overlap with all the possible databases which are now kept up with hundreds of very skillful institutions in the world on their technology base. This is not going to be substitute any of those. We are trying to guide the customer, which is developing country officer, into use the best available information and best available databases, and we somehow try to kind of help them in this jungle of information. But not indeed creating yet another database which then have to be searched by the customer. Maybe turn to we need further enhanced efforts. One definitely is that we have to put together all what the United Nations system can offer, and we need more better coherence building and even coordination. And that is what we are ready to do. My institution, my body, which is the body under the United Nations Framework Convention, is ready to engage itself into this endeavor. But one thing which is very important also is that we engage ourselves also with the financial institutions. I'm happy that after me there is a representative from the World Bank who is maybe giving some highlights on that side. Technology development and transfer without a clear, concrete end to be financed and be sustainable by financing is of course futile, and that's why we have to have cooperation and collaboration with financial bodies under the convention and also outside, and that is giving my kind of last message on my presentation. Maybe finally one notion is that it took us almost 15 years to negotiate and started to run a technology mechanism under one major convention of the whole UN system, climate change. It is now working, it is running. I hope that governments will be happy what they did, what they created, and I hope also that maybe this example, whether it is entirely applicable to everything, every field of the sustainable development, but at least you could look at this example and maybe think about whether some of it can be applicable to other fields like biodiversity, chemicals management, or other fields of sustainable development. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Mr. Wu, also kind and for this very insightful presentation. I think that gives a very interesting overview of what exists already, and I have to say that looks quite impressive. I would now like to turn to the next panelist, Mr. Xiong Zhang, who, as I explained, is the Senior Program Coordinator of the Clean Technology Fund and Scaling Up Renewable Energy Program at the World Bank, and as we hope, he will certainly also address the whole financial part of the equation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak on this panel on the second dialogue on technology facilitation. I'm particularly humbled to speak after Mr. Jukka Uusukainen, who just gave a very compelling, comprehensive, and perhaps most relevant example of an existing technology mechanism in the climate change area. One thing that seemed to be largely untouched in these dialogues so far is financing. According to the Secretary General's reports, international financial institutions, funds, and partnerships are part of the technology transfer mechanisms under the proposed technology facilitation mechanism, as illustrated in Figure 4 of the September 2012 report. As the report A/67/348. The purpose of my presentation is to share with you the experience of the climate investment funds, what we do, how it works in financing the demonstration, deployment and transfer and dissemination of low carbon and climate resilient technologies. First, a little bit background on the climate investment funds. The climate investment funds were established in 2008 in the run-up to the Copenhagen COP to provide scaled-up climate financing to developing countries to initiate transformational change toward climate-resilient and low-carbon development. We talk a lot about scaled-up financing and transformation. These are perhaps two phrases associated with the CIF most. The CIF has benefited from 14 donors, and I have listed them here, Australia, Canada, Denmark, France, Germany, Japan, Korea, Netherlands, Norway, Spain, Switzerland, Sweden, UK, and the United States. Some of these were the original donors to the CIF. Others joined later on, after the establishment of the CIF. In total, the donors have pledged and contributed $8 billion to the CIF. And the CIF has been working with, so far, 48 countries that have prepared investment plans with an allocation of funding. There have been other countries who have expressed interest, actually dozens of them, that have not been able to join the CIF because we have allocated all the $8 billion to the existing countries already. The way CIF works is the money is channeled through the multilateral development banks, in this case, the World Bank Group, that includes the World Bank and International Finance Cooperation, and the four regional development banks, the African Development Bank, the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, the Inter-American Development Bank, and the Asian Development Bank. Next, please. We have four programs under the CIF. There are actually two funds, four programs. The first fund is the Clean Technology Fund. And the second fund is the Strategic Climate Fund. Under the second fund, there are three targeted programs. One is called Pilot Program on for Climate Resilience. The focus here is on adaptation. The second one is called FIP, the Forest Investment Program, that apparently focuses on forest and sustainable forest management. And the third targeted program is called SREP, Scaling Up Renewable Energy in Low-Income Countries. So the purpose of the CTF is to scale up demonstration deployment and transfer of low-carbon technologies in mostly middle-income countries, where there's a lot of potential to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And we focus on three sectors: renewable energy, energy efficiency, and sustainable urban transport. So far, 17 countries have benefited from the CTF, the Clean Technology Fund, through 15 country investment programs and one regional investment program. And I have listed all these countries, and if you look at the list here, they're mostly, actually all of them, are middle-income countries, large emitters of greenhouse gases, perhaps with the exception of China, which is not part of the CTF. And under SREP, so far we have eight countries that have received an allocation ranging from $30 million to $50 million per country. Most of them are in Africa. And there are five additional countries that are developing their investment plans. Recently, we have invited all eligible countries, defined in World Bank terms, the IDA-only countries, to express their interest to participate in SREP. And I'm pleased to inform, as of this week, we have received about 40 expressions of interest from these low-income countries to participate in SREP. Among these four programs, as you can see, CTF is the one that has specifically mentioned technology and technology transfer. SREP, as the title implies, also has a technology focus on renewable energy technologies. PPCR and FIP have less of a focus on technology. Next, please. This map shows the CIF countries, both the contributor countries, 14 of them, and the recipient countries, 48 of them, on this map. Next, please. Now, the Clean Technology Fund. As I explained, the purpose of the fund is to provide middle-income countries with resources to explore options to scale up the demonstration, deployment, and transfer of low-carbon technologies. So far, we have $5.5 billion pledged and contributed to the CTF. And these funds have also or are expected to leverage an additional, I think, about $20 billion. The co-financing ratio is about 1 to 8.5 overall for the CTF portfolio. And let me show you the governance structure. Next, please. This slide shows you the governance structure of the CTF. Right now, there are 8 contributor countries sitting on the board of the CTF and 8 recipient countries. So there is a balanced representation on the board, or what we call the Trust Fund Committee. And then we have other UN agencies like UNDP, UNEP, UNFCCC, as well as GEF, civil society and private sector as observers to the CTF. The World Bank is the trustee. The CIF is administratively hosted by the World Bank, somewhat independent from the World Bank, as we work with other regional development banks as implementing agencies. And we work at the Secretariat, the so-called administrative unit of the CIF. And the World Bank and the 4 regional development banks are the implementing agencies. Next, please. So far, among the $5.5 billion pledged to the CTF, about $3.3 billion has been approved already. And in the CTF pipeline, we have about, right now, 120 projects and programs. And if you look at the funding that has been approved, that's the pie charts that are shown here in this slide. It's probably a bit too small for everyone to see. About 60% of the funding has gone to renewable energy technologies, 15% to sustainable urban transport, and about 20% to energy efficiency. And there's also about 7% clean energy type of projects for which we cannot identify the specific sector. They're typically private sector programs working with financial intermediaries that do not identify the specific technology or sector until the sub-programs or the sub-projects have been developed. Among the renewable energy technologies, as you can see from the smaller pie chart, most of it, or about half of it, has gone to solar energy. And this is largely because we have a very large technology-focused program in the MENA region, the Middle East and North Africa, involving Morocco, Egypt, Tunisia, and Jordan, in concentrated solar power. In addition, we also have CSP programs in India, in Chile, and in South Africa. And this is mainly the reason why we have such a large share of solar energy, because these programs typically are very large. Just in one program in the MENA region is originally $750 million. After the revision of the investment plan, I think it has come down a little bit, $660 million. But we have similar programs in India, in South Africa, and Chile, also in the range of $100 to $200 million per program. After solar, we also have quite a bit of funding going to wind in about 10 countries, and we also have projects supporting geothermal technology, for example, in Indonesia. Indonesia received an allocation of $400 million, and out of that, $300 million has been allocated to geothermal energy technologies. Next, please. The other program that I mentioned that has a technology focus is SREP, Scaling Up Renewable Energy in Low-Income Countries. This is a relatively small program relative to the size of the CTF. CTF, about $5.5 billion, and SREP, about one-tenth that size, $550 million in terms of funding. As I said, right now we have 8 countries with an allocation of SREP funding, but the program may expand very quickly if additional funds are made available. The financial leverage for SREP, I think it varies from country to country and from program to program. Not many projects have developed so far. I think only about 5 or 6 programs have been approved for funding. It's taking a little bit longer for some countries, and some countries also have political situations that have slowed down the development of the programs. Mali, for example. In terms of governance, the CTF has its own board with 8 recipient countries and 8 contributor countries. For SREP, there are 6 recipient countries and 6 contributor countries sitting on the board, what we call the subcommittee of SREP. Next, please. I think in... let me just talk a little bit on how countries access CIF funding and how it works. The way it works, basically, an eligible country, this is, applies to the CTF. For SREP, it's a little bit different. The country expresses their interest, and after we get the green light from the board, the country can request a joint mission among the MDBs, and they help the countries develop an investment plan. It's a business plan between the country and the multilateral development banks. In the investment plan, the priority sectors, technologies are identified, sometimes including project ideas and expected outcomes. The trust fund committee endorses these investment plans with an allocation of funding. After that, the country works with the MDBs to develop those project ideas and send them to the Trust Fund Committee for funding approval. Following that, the MDB board will approve the project. And after funding approval, the rest of the procedures, the rest of the project cycle follows that of the MDBs. So we are pretty lean in terms of management. Our secretariat is about 24 people managing $8 billion. And we don't get involved in project implementation. The projects are managed and implemented by the countries working with the MDBs. Before I conclude, let me just give a few observations related to the technology facilitation discussion. The CIF process in developing investment plans, setting priorities, and identifying technologies is driven by the recipient countries. CIF takes a programmatic approach and aims to achieve transformative impact. MDBs are brought together to coordinate and support the countries. Country-level coordination varies. Some programs, some countries are stronger and better than others. CIF does not get involved in technology R&D. And I think I heard the same thing from other UN institutions yesterday. What we do is to support scaled-up demonstration. We do get involved in demonstration. I gave you the example of concentrated solar power. That certainly is an example of a demonstration of relatively new technologies, but these are all commercially available technologies. And it supports scaled-up deployment and dissemination of mature technologies. The Climate Investment Funds, the CTF in particular, achieves technology transfer mainly through investments using highly concessional finance, with technical assistance, capacity building, and creation of enabling environment. If you look at the terms of even the CTF, we provide some grant funding, even when we provide loans. These are highly concessional, almost zero interest loans. For the public sector, the interest, there are two options. One is 0.25, the other is 0.75% interest. So these are very, very highly concessional finance. ASIF is not, in a way, part of the UN system. It's not under the guidance of the UN FCCC, and it's not an operating entity of the UN FCCC's financial mechanism. Although we do provide lessons learned to the Green Climate Fund and to others, and this is also one of the reasons why the CIF was created. CIF does not profess to be a technology transfer mechanism, but it seems to fit under the proposed technology transfer mechanism, as I was reading the background document. Let me stop here, and thank you again, Chair, for giving me the opportunity to speak on this panel. Thank you.
Well, I have to thank you for once again another very interesting and insightful presentation, which shows that there is money around, plenty of money, but apparently there is also even more interest for more investment and more need for funds out there. I would, as the third presenter, now like to give the floor to a panelist from Costa Rica, Mr. Jose Zaglul, president of the Earth University in Costa Rica. You have the floor, and I see there is also already a very nice picture of, I guess, the campus of your university.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a problem when I'm introduced as president of Earth. The other day, President Obama came to Costa Rica, and he was introduced to me. He says, "I'm Barack Obama, president of the United States." I said, "I'm Jose Zaglul, president of Earth." He was depressed for a while. But being president of Earth, I'm sorry, this is the first time you invited me to the UN building. Well, Earth University is an international, private, nonprofit university, and it's located in the in that campus, which is in the middle of the rainforest in Costa Rica, which is very typical of the rainforest of the world. And it was placed there with the purpose of trying to discover ways to develop or to protect the rainforest, or to develop things that were not going to destroy this area that is only 7% of the planet, but has between 50 and 80% of the biodiversity of the world. It was established 25 years ago, and I'm going to give a presentation about what we're doing to promote sustainability, to alleviate poverty, to cooperate amongst ourselves, and to make a change in the world. And we believe that education is the greatest tool we have. But education at this time has certain characteristics that are not the best. For example, we choose students to come to college, to university, basically by an entrance exam. And this happens all over the world. And an entrance exam for people that are in very economically underprivileged areas from rural schools probably would never have a chance to make it to college if they had to pass that exam. So apparently what we're doing is providing education and opportunities that those that have most, and leaving aside those that need it most. So we believe that the leadership of the world, the people that are going to help us in making the technology transfer successful, the people that are going to alleviate poverty, we have to reach out to them for them to be the leaders of change in their country. So education for us is very important. And the other thing is that, you can put the first one, yeah.
Okay.
The other thing is that we have been educating and measuring success by how much wealth we make. And I think that part of our social concern, the social sensibility, the environment, is not stressed enough. Sometimes the economic growth is much more important than the impact in the environment. So how do we do to change? Because in sustainability, there is also the consumption. And I will say that the consumption in developing countries and the energy use in developed countries, it's also not sustainable. And sometimes in the developing countries too. So how do we balance that? Well, we started with this mission, which is simple, short, but very profound, is that we want to prepare leaders with ethical values to contribute to the sustainable development of the tropics and to construct a just and prosperous society. So the word leaders, ethics, sustainability, and justice and prosperity is there. Are we capable of forming a leader that cares about the environment, the society, and at the same time be able to promote prosperity in the countries? And I would like to show how we do this. Well, first of all, we have faculty from about 20 countries, and the students come to Earth come from 36 countries, from all over Latin America, the Caribbean, and 14 countries from Africa. But we go out and look for them. We go to as the faculty that goes to the most remote communities. We try to meet with the applicant. We interview them. It's usually two faculty members that go, and we try to discover in them that leadership capacity. Sometimes we know that they have to walk to school for 2 hours, and maybe they don't have electricity at home, and then they have been able to overcome those challenges. So maybe the exam that we give them, an exam, does not reflect that they are the best academically, not because they are not intelligent, but because they haven't had the opportunity. But we choose them and we bring those kids that probably will have never gone to college in their country and bring them up to speed in the academic area, and they become excellent professionals and leaders of change in their country. So I just want to say this briefly, because 60% of our students are totally financed with tuition, room and board, and 100% are subsidized. So, and then when we bring them to Earth, we want these four pillars that you see on the screen to be of equal weight. We want them to be socially and environmentally committed in every course, in every activity. Even the buildings that we build have that environmental aspects that would use the least kind of energy possible, fossil energy. Of course, the technical and scientific knowledge is very important for us, but we are an experiential and participatory kind of learning process where we put the emphasis in the learning and not the teaching, and that makes a whole difference. We want the students to learn, and they learn at different speeds. So you have to pay attention to each one. And our curriculum is an integrated curriculum, and the professor is just a facilitator of the learning process. The classrooms are not bigger than 24, 25 students per class. And then the previous one. And then the personal or the values is very important. For us, it's as important that the student is honest, he works in teams, it's not that emphasis that you have to be the best of the class and then don't share anything with your classmate. No, on the contrary, we want them to be able to work in teams, and they have to have what we call the capacity to listen to each other. They come from different backgrounds, different countries, as we are represented here, and we have to respect each other. So we want to resolve conflict through dialogue and not through fighting, and that everybody has ideas and we should respect them. So honesty, teamwork, tolerance, respect is very important for us. And if they don't respect or if they don't follow these values, they can flunk like an exam too. And finally, we want them to become job creators rather than job seekers. So they have to form a business while they're on campus that has the environmental and social impact and obviously the financial impact. And we put 5 students from different countries and different socioeconomic backgrounds to work together. And then they present a feasibility study and we give them a loan. We become a bank. And they do their business from zero to marketing their product. And that changes their mentality. It's a 2-year project. And we live in an 8,000-acre property. So they can develop the business, they can sell it, they pay rent, they pay everything. But that creates a sense of wanting to create businesses that are sustainable. And I won't say much more about Earth, but it's just that formation gives them a real sense that they can make a difference in their countries. And 80%, after 25 years, 80% are back in their countries. And about 70%, according to our survey, do social and environmental work. I'm not going to talk too much about the graduate profile, but for us, this is very important that they have these characteristics if we want a different world, that they are leaders, they behave according to their values and the principle, they communicate effectively, and are really concerned about the environment and the impact in society. And let me tell you some of the examples that we have undertaken to make some changes, and I would like to be specific about certain things because you talk about collaboration, but in our property, there were 300 hectares planted to banana trees. And when we got there, the picture on your left or on your right, on whatever, on your left, where you see that waste, in all the banana companies, that waste was thrown next to the rivers. And then when the flood came, all that center part of the bunch and each plastic bag that cover each banana bunch will go to the rivers and will contaminate the rivers, the oceans, the turtles will eat thinking that it's food, they will die. And we went to the companies and we told them, let's see what we can do with this waste in order to clean up all this material that is so contaminant. And they said, no, that's the cost of doing business. And again, I'm going about ethics and business. So I told them, but somebody has to clean that, and we have to get rid of that. And they said, you are a communist. I said, okay, I am. So they didn't want to help. So we started taking that plastic, find ways to recycle it, and you see that blue, those blue corners are made out of plastic. We make waste container with the waste plastic. We converted the center part of the banana in banana paper. Now we can make paper out of the banana waste, and we transform the whole banana industry because the country made it a requirement that they could not throw this garbage away. We are only 300 hectares of bananas. But there are thousands of hectares planted to bananas, and that contamination was not only in Costa Rica, but all over the country that they produce bananas. And then we found out that you don't have to get rid of all the grass under the bananas and use herbicides. We can just clean with a machete, use effective microorganisms to produce fertilizer, and reduce the amount of chemicals and use organic fertilizer by utilizing efficient microorganisms that are non-pathogen microorganisms that you mix with biomass and release nutrients, and we reduce the amount of chemical fertilizer. Now, it costed us about 25 U.S. cents per box of 40 pounds to do what we were doing. and nobody will pay us the 25 cents for that box. And you say, well, 40 pounds, it should be like 1 cent more per pound of banana, and nobody will pay that. So the students wouldn't believe us that doing sustainability was a good business until Whole Foods came, and Whole Foods decided to buy directly our bananas. So we provide Whole Foods now with all the bananas that they sell, and we were the first whole trade product at the Whole Foods store. And just by paying a few cents more, you protect the workers, you give them fair wages, you don't contaminate the environment. And we are not a banana-producing university. What we want to sell is a dream that you can do business in a way that is sustainable, and that by paying a few more cents, you can change things and you can reduce environmental impact. So when we talk about collaboration, you know, sometimes I think, are we really so committed to make changes at the expense sometimes of losing or not being so profitable? Or is it that we want to make as much profit independent of the impact that we have in the environment? This is another experiment that we did with products of the rainforest. You know, the rainforest was being devastated at a very fast rate. And there is a disease in Latin America, some of you may know, it's endemic to Latin America called Chagas disease. 20 million people are infected, and about 10 to 20,000 people die per year. It's the poor man's disease because it's transmitted by a kissing bug. And it's usually in thatch houses, in old houses, and mostly the poorest people are the ones that get it. We went to the pharmaceutical companies and asked them if they will help us to find a cure for the Chagas disease. They said, no, you know, poor people don't pay for medicine. So they were not interested. So with several universities in Latin America and the NASA and the University of Alabama in Birmingham, we started a project, and what we did was to crystallize vital enzymes of the parasite in the space, because in the space you don't have gravity. So when you crystallize the protein, you can find a very good molecular structure. It's much better than when you crystallize on Earth because of the gravity forces. And we were able to isolate three vital enzymes of the parasite. And from extract of the rainforest, we were able to block in vitro that enzyme of the parasite. And this is an incurable disease yet. Anyhow, we were able to get to in vitro, and then the funding stopped because the people that were giving us the funding, they stopped for other reasons. But again, you know, I as we talk about the cooperation and collaboration, I wonder whether in this kind of efforts there is a clear conscience of the companies, of people, of how to reach out to those that need it most. And sometimes it doesn't happen, and that's why I'm giving these examples here. And the other kind of collaboration that we're doing is that we have partnered with RU Forum, which is the University Consortium of African Universities, in order to learn from each other. They are very interested in our entrepreneurial focus, the leadership capacity. So for many years, now we have about 32 universities are participating, but we also have about maybe 70 students from Africa with us and several graduates back in Africa. So this kind of partnership south to south is very important. Sometimes, I'm glad what you mentioned about the collaboration from the north. And since this is a meeting to talk very frankly, sometimes the organizations that have the resources come with their own answers, and the people, we in the developing countries, have to accept or not what they are practically imposing on you. And I wish that the partnership was more horizontal. And sometimes it happened to us, we were helping a community, and we thought that our help had to be in agriculture, but they wanted to level the soccer field. And we said, we cannot give you our equipment to level the soccer field. We can help you in agriculture, in producing more. No, we want to level the soccer field. And we couldn't do any advancement in that community. Well, finally, we helped them level the soccer field. And what happens is that's where they play soccer, that's where they meet. And once we leveled the soccer field, we were able to be very effective in transmitting the knowledge. So what I want to say with this example is that we have to work, you know, trusting and working together with the recipient country in how to do things. And sometimes the regulations are so inflexible, like they are the same all over the world, while countries and institutions change from one place to another. Now we also have a very interesting program that is supported by the MasterCard Foundation, in which we want to create a global master program in health and sustainability. And this is going to be a joint collaboration between the American University of Beirut and Earth University, an African institution, an Asian institution, and a U.S. institution. And the graduate will rotate in these countries. What we help to achieve there, again, is to interact with different cultures, different countries, even different political situations, so that to bring harmony and respect among each other apart from the discipline that is being taught here. In terms of the things that we have shared with other countries is that we have, this is not new technology, but we have making this technology adaptable to small farmers and large companies using biodigesters all over Latin America. You can use the waste to process it. The methane that was going to be discharged to the environment is put into this plastic bags, and then the methane can be converted to electricity or to heat, and methane is converted to CO2. Methane is 25 times more damaging than the CO2, and then you can use that energy to for purposes of cooking or lighting, or just convert it to electricity. And what has happened is that in Central America, there is a lot of wood used for cooking. But this, for example, this is in Copan in Honduras. This is a more sophisticated biodigester, but small farmers can have one biodigester, and it costs about $125, let's say $200, to put a biodigester, and with two cows or two pigs, you can produce enough energy for 8 hours constantly for a Bunsen burner, and you don't have to use wood. We also, on campus, we have the only renewable energy laboratory in Central America, and we are training people from all Central America with the cooperation of the German government. And another example of and this will be the last one, I don't want to talk too much and wait for the questions, but we are very proud of how our graduates are changing their communities. Sharon is a graduate from Uganda. She would have never gone to school, but she came with a scholarship to Earth. She returned to Uganda, and she decided that she wanted to start helping medium and small entrepreneurs, women entrepreneurs, that were producing products but could not sell them, and they had no access to the information technology. And she made it accessible to them and to market the products directly. And she's been so successful that five other countries in Africa are asking for her company to help in other in these countries. And another graduate, Francis Nimikunda from Uganda, after graduating from Earth, he went back and started a school with 450 kids from elementary school. And he came from a very small village, and he is transforming not only his village, but the lives of hundreds of students. So I wanted to give these examples because I think that the only way that we can transform our societies, and we that are in the academic institution have tremendous possibilities to make a change in the world, because most of the leaders of the government, of the business sector, of the social sectors are usually university graduates. But we have to instill in them that commitment, that concern about giving back and not taking everything. And sometimes, or most of the time, when you give without asking for anything in return, is when life is happier to you. That part that has no monetary return, but satisfaction as a spiritual satisfaction, knowing that you supported to make a change, a positive change, is something that has to be instilled in our societies. And so I'll end with that note. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, President Zaghloul. I think, from my point of view, you deserve the denomination President of Earth. I think you really made a very graphic, in the best sense of the term, a vivid and compassionate demonstration, you know, what can be achieved through education. And when I looked into the audience, I saw that you captured people's attention. You know, people were really attentively listening to what you said. And I think hopefully your example of your university can be copied without any property rights elsewhere in the world. I think that would be, I think, the best outcome of your presentation. I would now like to open the floors for comments, questions to the panelists. Once again, I ask you to be as interactive as possible, to ask questions, to comment. And I have, as the first speaker on my list, Japan. In order to allow as many colleagues as possible to interact and to speak, I would like you to limit your interventions to 3 minutes, please. Thank you very much. Japan.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator, for giving me this opportunity. And I also like to thank the panelist for very rich, useful presentation. It was quite impressive. We learned there are so many tremendous ongoing efforts have been made by different entity, academia, institution. And we also heard these efforts may be better coordinated through new mechanism. And I also learned many entities, including CTCN, try to coordinate by themselves with many other entities like UNIDO or UNEP, or try to World Bank, just like World Bank, try to scale up the initiative. So my first question is to Mr. Ji-Hong Juan from World Bank. Do you think the new mechanism, if it is created something, will be able to coordinate among activities that have been decided by or are being implemented through different governing body structures, including like CTCN or UNESCO and WIPO, as you said, especially JEF or World Bank. I see there might be another risk that it could result in creating another fragmentation. What is your view on how we could avoid creating another further fragmentation? Because I noticed Mr. Dr. Wolf-Kaisen mentioned it's very important to make sure how the people get to right information. At the same time, there are so many information. And I was also surprised during the session yesterday. Today, Japan engaged in a lot of initiative and effort in many projects. To be honest, I don't know much about this individual initiative Japan engaged in, and maybe the different ministries are responsible for different initiatives implemented by different institutions. So to me, even in Japan, within my country, it's a little bit difficult to coordinate among each other. So how to achieve this at the global level, UN level? My second question is to Mr. Wolf-Kaisen. What are your view on fragmentation and decentralization? We heard many panelists, including you, are saying that both technology need and capability differ among countries. There are different need or capability country by country or within country, a different area, a different village need different capability. There are different need and different capability. How effectively do you think if this new mechanism established will be able to work to facilitate technology cooperation? In other words, how we can strike a balance between perspective from global level and perspective from local level, or you mentioned the CTCN. CTCN is taking bottom-up approach. So how to make sure to strike a balance between this bottom-up and up, top-down approach? Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed for your questions. Next on my list, I have Guatemala, followed by the Islamic Republic of Iran. Guatemala, please.
Muchas gracias, señor cofacilitador, y agradecemos a todos los panelistas. Fue de veras un muy inspirador escucharlos. Tengo una serie de preguntas al señor don José. Es cierto que su presentación ha sido muy valiosa y quisiéramos saber si se creara este mecanismo de tecnología, ¿cómo cree que podría ayudar la Universidad de la Tierra? ¿En qué tipo de colaboración usted vería entre entre la Universidad de la Tierra y lo que estamos nosotros tratando de plantear, que es este mecanismo integrador de tecnologías de todo tipo para lograr un desarrollo sostenible? Y también al señor Yuka de la UNFCCC, mi pregunta es, ¿cuáles son las limitaciones del mecanismo bajo la Convención Marco de Naciones Unidas de Cambio Climático y cómo cree que este mecanismo que creemos que debería de ser más holístico, cómo podría trabajar ambas estructuras? Gracias.
Muchas gracias por sus preguntas. I give now the floor to the colleague from Iran, please.
Thank you very much, Ambassador. Let me again thank you for the way you're chairing this meeting, and also thanks go to our panelists for their very informative interventions. I think so far there has been a common common word that going beyond this fragmentation, we should see it through the prism of having a possible new mechanism on how to coordinate or monitor these different and diverse activities. And that is very, very important subject that we can see that the different experience from different parts, especially that is this session focused on somehow environment and climate, is feeding into this process so that we can take advantage of them. And to my delegation, it would have been pretty much better and more advantageous if we could have other pillars of the sustainable development also present here so that we could discuss not only on the environmental issues but also on the other two pillars of sustainable development as well. Taking the points from the panelists, I would like to raise a few comments regarding to the issues raised by Mr. Yuka. I fully agree with the embarking points when he said that there is fragmentation and there is not that much concerted efforts to overcome the tech barriers. And from there, I would like to raise a few questions. The first one would be that is there anything that the UN could do in a global wise so that it can be better coordinated, monitored, and implemented? And the second question would be that do you think that a global UN-like monitoring or evaluation mechanism would be of any help in taking all these initiatives out of, as we have here in our topic of the day, out of fragmentation? The second panelist, I would like to raise the issue that he referred in an elegant manner what his field of activity and what the World Bank is doing in terms of the issues related to the environment by referring to CIF, CTF, and SREP. I have a question that is there any other example of the World Bank activity? I'm sure that it is not probably within his field of activity, but it could be referred here as a kind of fragmented initiative that is being carried out in terms of tech transfer. And the next one would be that what might be, he, in a very excellent manner, explained the different mandates, different fields of activities, but what would be the possible barriers and how could they be overcome, be it in the World Bank structure or in terms of facilitation mechanism? And another point that was capturing my attention was the point that was raised by Mr. Yuka that almost 80 countries have carried out technology need assessment. And there are some general recommendations to be made, and he referred to two kinds of recommendations. The first one was that economic and financial, and the second one, regulatory and policy. And my question is that since countries are evaluating this kind of activities and giving recommendations, so they're not saying regulatory problems to themselves. Probably they're saying regulatory problems within the multilateral international level. What might be those kind of regulatory and policy barriers that could be mentioned here? Thank you very much. And overcome probably. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your questions. I have now on my list India, followed by Brazil. India, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and for giving me the floor. And let me start off by thanking our panelists for their very useful presentation this morning. I have a couple of questions for Mr. Yuka and Mr. Chang, but I'll preface that with a few comments based on the issues that we have discussed. Once again, I think it is important to realize that this is not the first time we are discussing the issue of fragmentation. We had a very long debate in the technology workshops last year, and I was just going through a summary of those workshops. We had Dr. Bazilian last time, who also represented CTCN. So it's very enriching to have that debate again, and it's very, very useful. One thing which was quite clear listening to the panelists is that there is a lot of fragmentation in international efforts. At the same time, there is a very rich tapestry of what is happening in the world. There are different organizations working towards our common goal of sustainability. I think if you go back why this fragmentation has come about, I think it's fully justified. I think what has happened is that over the course of the last two decades, as we have evolved our understanding towards sustainability, we have been looking at sustainability in different silos. We have been looking at issues of climate change and agriculture and transportation, resources, information and communication technologies, energy technologies. All of those silos, all of those sectors have been looking at sustainability in their own areas. So that is perhaps why we are having such a rich but a slightly fragmented approach. The way I could understand from the panelists today, I thought fragmentation manifests itself at various levels. There is fragmentation, for example, geographically, in the sense that needs of countries and what countries are doing are widely different. There is, for example, a fragmentation between our technological cluster with the finance cluster, which Mr. Chang very ably brought about. The two don't often talk to each other as much as they are required to. There is also a sectoral fragmentation, which I just referred to, every sector talking about sustainability in their own silos. There is also a fragmentation among different international agencies, which follows from the sectoral fragmentation. And then there is also one final point. The fragmentation also exists along the different stages of technological cycle. For example, Mr. Yuka from CTCN, I thought the effort that CTCN is making is mostly on the side of technology diffusion. You are not so much focused on technology development or, for example, other stages of the technological cycle. There is also a fragmentation there. And I think in that sense, it is a useful debate to have, because what we are trying to consider arrangements for a mechanism which can help us bring up to date with the kind of debate we are having in the UN right now, where we are trying to move away from that silo approach and bringing everything together under the framework called sustainable development. We have spoken about this for a long time, but finally, I think as we craft the SDGs and the post-2015 development agenda, we are trying to bring everything together, converge all these silos, because we have finally realized that all these silos do add up to a single whole. So coming to a couple of questions that I had for Mr. Yuka particularly, what I saw is that your role is mostly advisory. You bring people together, advise people on what is to be done. But, and correct me if I'm wrong, the aspect that the CTCN would be focused on, for example, will be projects which primarily climate benefit. Now, what I want to understand and ask you perhaps is that, do you see a slight difference between looking at from a climate change perspective and sustainability, which in our view, when you look at sustainable development and the three pillars, is slightly broader? Now, how do you address the issue of sustainability in a slightly broader sense? Secondly, I think you mentioned that you work in response to country requests. Now, that will obviously presume that the countries have the capacity to know what to request for. In many cases, that may not be true. How do the countries know, for example, that finance and regulations are the barriers and not something else? How about local capacity development for the long term? Once you match the solution providers from outside to the local needs, we might lead to a short-term solution but may not lead to a long-term capacity addition. So those are the questions that I thought if you could kindly elaborate apart from the issue of sustainability. And to Mr. Chang from CIF, you yourself mentioned very usefully that you see that the CIF can play a very important role as part of the proposed technology facilitation mechanism. So if you could kindly also elaborate on how you think or what kind of arrangements, and I think that applies to a question to all the panelists, what kind of arrangements can we put in place for this proposed mechanism, which we can actually usefully tap into, create synergies between all these ongoing efforts in different fields, and to avoid duplication and to create create a seamless approach towards sustainable development. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I thank you for your questions. I now give the floor to Brazil, followed by Indonesia.
Thank you, Mr. Co-moderator. Allow me to congratulate all the panelists for their excellent presentations, which provided us with inspiring ideas for possible institutional arrangements for a technology transfer mechanism. Oh, I have many questions. I tried to bring them together into two main issues, building on what has already been said by my previous distinguished colleagues. The first one is on the very idea of fragmentation, and especially to Mr. Zhang. We noticed that, as we could see today yesterday, and especially in the workshops that were held last year, that there are many things, initiatives, ongoing initiatives on technology transfer throughout all the technology cycle. There's an image, a figure, in the first report from Secretary General, the figure 3. Mr. Zhang mentioned the figure 4, but the figure 3 is also very illustrative of this existing fragmentation. And the present, but my point is that this figure, although it's very illustrative, as I said, it does not reflect one important element, which is the fragmentation also between the different means of implementation, how to coordinate efforts on capacity building and more, especially on education. Yesterday we had a discussion on importance of engineering and information, and today Mr. Zaglu mentioned bring to us the importance of to have the right values. My point is, we are now working on a framework of thinking on the basis of a framework for the post-2015 development agenda within the high-level political forum and a new financing strategy. And in this framework, we see a very important role for technology transfer if the ambition, the transformative goals are to be implemented. In this regard, I'd like to ask Mr. Zhang, how does he see this mechanism on technology relating with this broader framework, especially with financing and capacity building? And in particular, if he sees the need for any particular or specific financing mechanism in this context. And second, much has been said on what would be the what are the goals of this mechanism, technology transfer mechanism. But we are also wanted to have some more views on what would be the functions, especially what's the meaning of coordination at such a global level, which respects the existing mandates, which focus on the specific needs, existing needs at the local and regional level, which respects the bottom up process that has been mentioned. What I'd like to hear more from the panelists. What are the meaning they apprehend from this concept of coordination at such level? I thank you very much.
I thank you very much for your questions. Now we'll give the floor to Indonesia, followed by the United States.
Thank you, moderators, and thanks to all the panelists for their presentations. I think it was very good and valuable information by all panelists, including information on collaboration and cooperation between stakeholders of development, such in the issues to address, let's say, in the issue climate change that have you mentioned, and also the issue of agriculture. From the presentation that delivered by the panelists, we do believe that the question that's being posed for decision are very relevant, actually, which, for example, the lack of information is really there, whereas many information delivered by the panelists not really easy to find out there. There is only one question that I would like to pose. What is actually the panelist's suggestion to making information for technology facilitation mechanism, as well as technology to support sustainable development, can be provided globally and can be utilized by all developing countries? Because is there any global platform needed to address this matter in unified and holistic manner, so that the lack of information regarding facilitation and technology mechanism can be addressed? Thank you.
Thank you. And for the time being, the last speaker on my list before we return for a first round of answers is the United States. Please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And thanks very much to all the panelists for their useful, helpful, and quite diverse presentations. I appreciated the reflection about the time it has taken to stand up the mechanism for climate change support. I think I heard about 15 years or so. And I also want to thank the president of Earth University. I appreciated your very specific examples of partnerships, South-South, with private sector partners, and with foundations. And my first question would be, how did you develop these partnerships? Did someone come to you? Did you work through some facility, or did you do this yourself at sort of the grassroots level through networks? For Mr. Ussukainen, I really appreciated the description of the work that CTCN does to give what seemed to be very focused and tailored support to a number of countries, and also appreciated hearing about the 80 technology needs assessments that have been conducted. I wondered if you could speak a bit more specifically about the value of these, maybe by giving an example of a particular country and how it used the TNA. And for Dr. Zhang, it was good to hear the examples of all the financial support, as clearly this was identified as a concern by CTCN. You mentioned that your processes are very country-driven, and I wondered, how is it that the countries identify their needs? Do they use the TNAs? Do they use other sources? How is it that they come to identify what it is they need when they come to your facilities and services? And it was also very helpful to hear about the SREP that focuses on least developed countries where there are still very great needs. Thanks to all of you, and I look forward to your responses.
Thank you very much indeed for your questions you posed to the panel. I would suggest we would go for a first round of answers because we have a very high number of questions which I think demonstrate the interest which this discussion provoked. So I would suggest we go in reverse order of the panelists, starting with you, Mr. Zaghloul. I think the common denominator, as I see it, of many questions, but there were specific ones, was how to address this issue of fragmentation, how to coordinate in relation to that the global with the local level. I think that's also an interesting question which I would like you also to address. So please, the floor is yours for a first round of answers. Thank you.
Thank you. I will start by answering the question that the representative from Guatemala made in terms of the mechanism of integration of technology, actually of the role that we can play in other countries. Actually, we have The institution itself is it's a Latin American institution, so it's based in Costa Rica, and as a matter of fact, Guatemala has the second largest group of students and graduates from Earth University, and we have association of graduates in the countries, and we have relationship with ministries and institution in most of the countries to try to implement sustainability and opportunities for these kids to come and study at Earth. And there has been an attempt by Norway, by USAID, and now by the MasterCard Foundation to try to learn from the experiences. And I'm not saying it's a one-way bridge, but how we need to change as academic institution in providing the values, the new way of looking at development in a way. It's not business as usual what we have to do. It's business in a way that is sustainable. And we all have to change our mind and our way of doing things and utilizing energy. And this requires a change in behavior. And answering to the U.S. representative, we did take the initiative of reaching out to African universities and Asian universities at one time with the support of U.S. universities also that participated in a series of events called SEMSIT, Sustainability Education and the Management of Change in the Tropics. And what we tried to do was to share the university experience amongst all of us and how to be innovative. You know, sometimes we academicians, it takes us years to change. And the world is changing very fast. I don't know whether it's religion or of academicians that change faster, but I don't know. But it takes us 500 years to change, you know. So we need to transform education. And in that respect, we had a series of five seminars in Thailand, in Costa Rica, in Uganda, at the Salzburg Seminar in Austria, and finally in Norway, where we discuss the needs for change in university. And as you talk about the impact of technologies and coordinating, you know, I feel that we can pour money into countries, but if the recipient is not able to, doesn't have the preparation and the commitment, that support may be lost. So that's why I think that education is a medium and long-term process. We want that leadership in the countries to make the change. We have technologies, we have opportunities, but we also need the people to make the change. So fortunately, we are non-profit. We have been able to find sources of funding. We have to get close to $15 million per year to support the program that we have. And this is done by going around. You know, I travel a lot trying to convince people that investing in education and especially investing in values, investing in social commitments, investing in ethical leaders, it's the best investment that we can make for the future. And I know it's very hard, but for 25 years we've done it, and it's working. It's not easy to do that, but I'll encourage the delegates here to think on a new kind of education that we can promote in the countries. And answering to one of your questions, I don't know whether it was the gentleman from Indonesia, what is it that we have to do to put everything together and be successful? And you know, why don't we put a goal like Costa Rica did for the year 2021, become carbon neutral? And then if you put the goal, maybe you can achieve it if you make then all your efforts will be concentrated to make that change. Even actually, our university is carbon plus. So if we have a goal, I think with that goal we can do all the other practices that will lead us to something as effective as it could be as becoming all carbon neutral. But we have to dream and put an ambitious goal.
Thank you. May I just ask you that since there was one specific question from Guatemala, if I understood it quite rightly, on to what extent you believe a university like yours could benefit from such a mechanism, such a transfer technology mechanism, if it existed. Could you maybe give an answer to that?
If it existed in Guatemala?
No, internationally.
Internationally, okay, I'm sorry. There is a strong desire to create a similar institution in different parts of the world. For example, in Africa, there is an effort now. And I think, you know, I'm not saying that this it has to be exactly like Earth, but if we, the mission is very specific in all the courses and everything that we do is about sustainability, social impact. And sometimes in other educational institutions, we focus in other disciplines and we leave those aspects away from our common, from day-to-day work. So I think that having this as an institution like this will greatly benefit the all the countries. And if that, I don't know whether I got the question right.
Thank you.
Well, I don't think I did.
Yeah. We're here all to express views, so I think that contributes to the kind of decision shaping and fact finding. I would now like to give the floor to our colleague from the World Bank. You have been asked quite a number of questions as they go also in the direction of coordination, you know, avoiding duplication, how to work with existing mechanisms. Also, the issue of finance has come up, so the task is yours. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I think in a way it depends on how you look at fragmentation. Just using the climate investment funds as an example, this is one sort of institution. It's not an independent institution, but there are actually six boards, which I did not mention in my presentation. First, you have two funds. The Clean Technology Fund, which has its own board, its own trust fund committee. And then you have the Strategic Climate Fund, which has its own board. Then under the Strategic Climate Fund, there are three targeted programs. On adaptation, the PPCR, on forest, the FIB, and on renewable energy for low-income countries, SREP. Each of these programs also has its own board, what we call the subcommittee, with a balanced representation of contributor countries and recipient countries. There you can see, even with something like this that we're managing, there are already separate boards. And each fund, each program will respond to its own board in a way. And of course, we do coordinate, and it's much easier for us to coordinate. Among, for example, you know, we have these 14 donors, then we have 48 recipient countries. But going beyond that, in fact, in other forums, since I work on climate finance, you hear a lot about fragmentation of climate finance. With the existing financial mechanism, the operating entities, and then you have the new operating entity that has just been created, the Green Climate Fund. Then you have the existing operating entity, the Global Environment Facility. These are under the convention. And then you have so many others, like the CIF, that are outside the convention. So people talk a lot about fragmentation of climate finance. And if you consider financial institutions and funds as part of the technology mechanism, I don't think you can avoid the situation of
fragmentation. As long as there is fragmentation of financial mechanism or financial sources, there are going to be fragmentation of technology mechanism. Now, for climate change, I think to a large extent, as you heard the presentation from Ilka, the parties to the climate convention have made a lot of progress. It's not easy over the last 15 years. They've been negotiating on technology transfer, on technology finance. Finally, they have come up with something on those two mechanisms. Within other institutions like the World Bank, you'll be surprised there are actually over 1,000 trust funds. We're considered one of them. We're probably the super trust fund since we have $8 billion. Others may have, you know, just a few million. So coordination is not easy. And then if you look at the situation at the country level, our colleague from Japan mentioned the sort of lack of coordination in a donor country, say between the Ministry of Finance, which is our focal point, dealing with the World Bank or the climate investment funds. Then you have other ministries like Ministry of Environment and Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And remember, in my prior job working at the Global Environment Facility, you'll see the funding to the GEF, in fact, actually are channeled through different ministries, even within Japan. Then you have the situation of donor coordination between the donors. And sometimes that's also a challenge, and sometimes that's also a reason why we see this proliferation of funds, because they want to see their own objectives achieved. And sometimes there's also a tendency of earmarking the funds so that they can achieve the objectives. In a way, it depends on how you look at the situation. In the CIF, we have these different targeted programs. In a way, it gives the donor the flexibility also to pledge to different funds. If they're particularly interested in low-income countries, LDCs in this case, they can actually pledge to SREP without pledging to the CTF. So, as I said, it depends on how you look at the situation of fragmentation in a positive way or in a negative way. Is it possible that a new mechanism would be able to coordinate all these partners and institutions and initiatives? Personally, I think it will be a huge challenge to achieve that goal. I think you need to look at, perhaps from the from an economist's point of view, the cost and benefit. Look at the functions that you want to propose, what you can achieve, and how much it's going to cost, and whether it's really worthwhile, and whether you'll be able to get there. And then at the recipient countries, I think we face similar challenges, even at the country level. For each initiative, each mechanism, you have their own focal points. Do they all talk to each other? I'm not sure they do. Even in the climate change space between the UNFCCC focal point, the GEF focal point, the CIF focal point, as well as the focal points dealing with other UN agencies and the World Bank and regional development banks. Do they work on programming together? In most cases, no. I think for the CIF, we have achieved some, somewhat limited programming across, for example, between GEF and CTF. We have seen some collaboration at the country level in the case of, for example, Indonesia, using different mechanisms for the same project. But overall, the lack of coordination has been a very big issue to achieve a common goal. Let me just stop here. I think the situation is so complicated, and I think the technology space is so vast, it's hard to fathom that one mechanism or institution will be able to fully coordinate these different aspects. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our colleague from Finland, please.
Okay, thank you very much. them and answer them properly. Japan was asking maybe about this kind of balance of a global oversight of technology transfer versus the local circumstances and bottom-up approach. Now, indeed, as I told, that in climate regime, we try to answer this kind of difficult question in such a way that CTCN is the one who answers the bottom-up requests. On the other hand, Technology Executive Committee is trying to form an oversight of what is happening on the technology transfer and development under climate regime and give that guidance then to the parties back. And indeed, when we get some lessons learned from the countries themselves, we are going to bring it up to the upper level, to the strategic level, so that then analysis can be done in this regime. So maybe these putting together might lead us to a better policy decisions by the parties in the convention. Guatemala was looking for a more holistic view and more holistic system for technology facilitation mechanism, of course, beyond the technology in under UNFCCC. And indeed, I can only ask that indeed the whole UN system do need to cooperate and collaborate to get a much better. It is a bit intriguing, though, that we know now that the donor countries from the north don't know what they are putting on technology transfer for sustainable development exactly, because there are so many actors in their countries to support the developing countries. And on the other hand, recipient countries also don't know by what channels they are receiving technology assistance and which ministries and which institutions are involved. So there is a lot of unclarity in both ends on the donors and recipient, and now there is a kind of hopeful wish that the international mechanism in between could sort out this problem. Iran also asked the Western about coordination on the global level and monitoring and evaluation. I would first say that indeed, almost like self-answered, monitoring and evaluation would be maybe one of the best practical tools and methods to try to get the overall picture, and that indeed should be somehow ensured. Then about coordination, again, I would say that where I come from, every single multilateral convention, agreement, legal setup, anyhow will do their own decisions by their own bodies. That means that the 200 members of the United Nations here are also there in the climate convention, in the biodiversity, on the chemical conventions, as well as also active in other spheres of the sustainable development. And indeed, those bodies are those who usually make the decisions for the actions on technology in their fields. Now, having some kind of overarching coordination body over all of that, which we have already established, would add another layer of governance. And there we maybe should be a bit cautious in that sense, that whenever there is an additional governance layer, there is additional delay of the actions. And I have to say that already in my work, when I'm working under the United Nations framework, where I have on the top of myself 20 governments in the specific advisory board, giving me the guidance and directions and criteria how to work for the CTC. And on the other hand, I'm part of the United Nations system as a staff member of the United Nations Environment Programme, working with the UNIDO, and there have their regulations, which of course are coming actually from this room and the other rooms from the New York, which they have to obey. So I also already have to kind of be steered by the two quite major institutions and somehow try to maneuver between these regulations, and that already entails quite a lot of work. On the on the question of indeed a very interesting question of where the findings from the Technology Executive Committee on the policy and regulatory framework, whether they were kind of international or national, I just refer to what the Technology Executive Committee concluded. It concluded that the governmental engagement in the technology need assessment process is fundamental to delivering predictable policies and creating appropriate regulatory frameworks to enable environments for investments and participation in innovative funding instruments such as public-private partnerships. So indeed, I think that the analysis was indeed coming from the national circumstances, and it is pointing out that we have to take not only kind of pure technological development, but also the policy development and policy environment into account when we talk about technologies and sustainable development. India was making an interesting remark on R&D. Indeed, R&D kind of phase is one of the most major gaps in the whole technology continuum, and we need to put more emphasis that who is helping developing countries in upgrading their R&D and where that cooperation should be enhanced. But indeed, CTCN would be interesting in helping countries also on R&D phase. And actually, one of the consortium members of the CTCN is Asian Institute of Technology. So we have a kind of institution which is familiar to R&D phase and other institutions as well. Actually, when I'm seeing the first of the requests coming from developing countries, it seems to be that we are kind of a bit pushed to more to the market side, to the diffusion and deployment side, which might not be the best needs for this kind of instrument which the parties have created. So indeed, we have to look more on that early phases of technology. On the one question from India about the relationship with climate and sustainability, I have to say that I have negotiated 16 years climate convention, as well as I have been in Johannesburg and in Rio Plus 20. I have never seen a major difference between these two regimes. Climate convention is sustainable development convention. Its basic articles are pointing directly to sustainable development. I hope that there is no error, there is no barrier or gaps between these two regimes. They actually are not two regimes. Climate is one of the regime to help in the sustainable development process, and indeed they should be really, really interrelated. There was the question of capacity to know what to ask. Exactly, this is a very important issue. How can we help developing country authorities, the designated focal points, to find themselves the best answer, even in the kind of quick issue, not only with the respond process, which might take months and even a year. And there we are indeed thinking about a more comprehensive capacity-building framework, especially for least developed countries, so that they can get easy access to this kind of capacities. And we already noticed that these regional workshops and seminars, which we have held already in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, are not enough. We have to go more to the regions, more on the thematic way, and we are going to do that one. Indonesia also asked about the question of lack of information and how information can be provided globally in a kind of supportive way. Again, I would refer to the knowledge management system, which we are now preparing for us. We have two major institutions who are willing to plan it and then start to piloting it in summer and in the fall. This should entail an interactive service. This is a very complicated and very difficult, but we try to have an interactive service for those countries who would like to get some guidance how to find right technologies among these huge amount of technologies, which even under climate is about 300 different technology areas where people are seeking for some, let's say, cutting-edge information. United States ask about the value of the technology need assessments and how they are coming together, how they are functioning. Are there very lessons learned? I would say that the best issue, or best, almost the best issue in the technology need assessments are that all the stakeholders in the country are coming together to look at the technology priorities in that country, and that there will be priorities accepted in this kind of coherent, systematic manner. We expect that this process would lead to a forming technology action programs and plans, and then finally these will be integrated in the country's own national appropriate mitigation actions as well as adaptation actions. Those NAMAs and NAPAs are the fundamental instrument how the developing countries can participate in the climate process, and these TNAs have to be instrumental on that. The Executive Committee has already made a guiding brief on this whole issue, and it's available in the UNFCCC literature. And I have to say that the first TNAs almost a decade ago, they maybe were not so good in the quality. We are learning. We have been learning. When we have now discussed with those countries who have conducted their technology need assessments, the discussion is excellent, very, very informed. So everybody has learned, both the institutions who have been involved in that and the countries who have been conducting. I think it's a very worthwhile instrument what the parties invented already 10 years ago. Maybe I'll finish here. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed to all the panelists for their explanations. We now have still time for a second round of comments or questions. I have, for the time being, one speaker on my list, which is Tunisia, to whom I'll give the floor just in a moment. But I just would like to invite others to ask questions and make comments as well. I already have another taker, Egypt and Liberia. So I give the floor to Tunisia first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like also to thank the panelists for their insightful and important presentations, and for answering some of the issues that have been raised. I think that through this discussion, you know, we can you know, say that there is the issue of transfer of technology or facilitation of technology is very complex issues, that the current capacity building activities and initiatives are so fragmented, and there is a shortage in assessing, monitoring, as well as checking whether the needs of specific countries, even though they are different, have been met or not through these initiatives. I have three comments or questions that I wanted also to add. First, one is we observe that much of the innovation in one, even one sector, derives from a convergence between several sectors. For instance, or for example, biopharmacy industry derives from ICTs, biotechnology, and nanotechnology. Saying that, there is a need in order for any international cooperation activity or initiative to be effective, there is a need to address all technology stages as all technology sectors at the same time. Is there any current mechanism or initiatives that brings together these different sectors and addresses the different technology stages? So this is the first question. The second one, member states, I think they are unable at currently to map out and quantify the international capacity building support needed, and they are also unable to make to monitor the extent to which these needs have been served. How to address this issue? Is the current international mechanisms and initiatives able to give an answer to this question? My third comment is related to capacity building. We observed and we noticed that most capacity building relates to the later stage of technology cycle, notably diffusion. And we've heard from panelists that there is a need to put more emphasis on the other stages of technology cycle, including R&D. And since most of developing countries experience a serious shortage of basic science and research capabilities, how, according to panelists, we can address this issue? Thank you so much.
I thank you for your questions, and I give the floor now to Egypt, followed by Liberia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would like to thank through you as well the panelists for the excellent presentation. One more time, we are learning about the interesting efforts that are going on, and once again, I believe that the more and more we're having this sort of discussions and this sort of exchanges, a kind of different parts of the picture start to become clearer to us. I think the idea now is that we need to put all these parts together so that we can have a look on how the overall picture would look like. And by saying that, I would believe that it is important to have this kind of interaction and exchange where we are seeing on the same podium the efforts with regard to technology needs assessment, capacity building, is interacting as well with universities and research and interacting with the finance pillar, because all of them are important for the overall effort and the overall picture. And once again, I don't want to repeat myself. I made this intervention yesterday, but once again, if we reach the agreement or the conclusion that we need to follow an integrated and comprehensive approach toward sustainable development, I think that the solution and the tools as well need to follow a more systemic and more comprehensive approach rather than a fragmented one. Yesterday, I referred to two levels of fragmentation between the efforts that are currently existing on international level with regard to technology cooperation, and fragmentation with regard to the technology cycle itself, as apparently there is more emphasis, as was rightly mentioned by previous speakers before me, on the diffusion part of the cycle rather than the initial parts, mainly research and development capacities. And I think this has been acknowledged by Mr. Otukan. Today I learned about two other new manifestations of this fragmentation which are important. There is a sectoral one, and I do take the point raised by Professor Dank. It's true that finance at the end of the day is very important part of the equation, how we are going to achieve any form of technology cooperation, whether it is regard to R&D or capacity building, without finance. So we need to have both in the same discussion. We need to see how this would fit there, and this is where we are seeing validity and usefulness of having some sort of coordination on UN level. It's not to change what is being done. It's actually to work what is being done. It's more to maximize what has been done and to put it in a more coordinated, synergized format. And I do take as well the point that this is can cause as well the current scenario, I mean confusion on the donor side and on the recipient side, where we can have different focal points addressing different streams or different mechanisms. And I would think that this can be even bigger if, for example, we are in the process of examining technology mechanism as well under CBD or another, a third one under the Convention on Desertification. And I know from following the meetings and discussion here that this thinking is there. It's not something that it is not there. So definitely we need to address this issue really in a more comprehensive and a coordinated manner. I do agree with the assessment of Professor Zhang that this is very challenging. It's true, and no one said that this is going to be an easy task. I believe that achieving sustainable development is quite challenging as well. And the point is that there is also an element of necessity. So while we are acknowledging the level of challenge we are facing, there is as well a necessity to proceed in this manner in order to have an outcome that would enable us of facing the these challenges. Having said that, I would like to address some questions to the panelists. To the three panelists, I would like to ask, based on your experience and assessment, what do you think is the missing link, sort of, so that if it is there, this will empower you really to have a far-reaching outcome than the one you would get from the existing scenario? What do you think really is a missing link that should be there? To give an example, I believe, for example, Dr. Ozukanen mentioned the issue of finance, and this is an important issue that is lagging and that is needed to strengthen and support the efforts undertaken with regard to technology. So this is the first question I would address to the three panelists, is about the identification of missing link. What do you think need to be done more so that we can have a better outcome? I would like to ask as well, what would be the role, in your view, and this would be more addressed to Dr. Ozukanen and Professor Dank, for the CTCN and the CTF in such a global UN mechanism, if it is created? What do you think the role of your institution would be in such coordinating platform or mechanism? And the third and last question is particularly to Professor Dank. It's regarding the finance issue. I understood from the presentation that the CTF mandate is mostly focusing on renewable energy, sustainable transport, and energy efficiency. If in a more coordinated fashion under the UN technology facilitation mechanism, the issue of finance is addressed, how do you see the contribution of your institution in this regard? For example, can it provide not only to finance, not only to specific projects and private sector, but for example, can there be an intervention on the level on R&D as it has been identified as one of the major gaps in a technology cycle? And I would end here. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. for your questions. In order to avoid fragmentation and promote coordination of the dialogue we have here, I invite delegations to ask their questions now so I can give them back to the panel for a last round of answers. I have, for the time being, Liberia and China on the floor, but I invite delegations to use the time available to ask questions if they still have some. Otherwise, I would then close the speakers list to give the panelists the opportunity to ask questions. But I already have now Liberia, China, and the European Union. So Liberia has the floor first.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much. I want to join the other speakers in thanking you for your high performance in the manner in which you are handling this meeting. And I also want to thank the panelists for the excellent deliberations and information they have provided to us. Chair, as our country from the least developed area, we continue to be concerned about our full integration in the global economy. We have capacity to develop to make contribution to global development. And so when we come to such a gathering, we are concerned about the things that are said and the actions that the international community continue to put on the table in favor of the LDCs. I will reserve questions on the LDC because the president of the coordination bureau of the LDC, our ambassador, will be a panelist this afternoon, and I don't want to preempt him. but I just want to take note that phrases like policy and regulatory problems is a problem for the LDCs. The need for capacity building in the LDCs is not a new saying. This has been repeated on a number of occasions in a gathering such as these. However, I will just want to while I have also extended thanks to all the panelists, I want to extend thanks to the additional thanks to the president of Earth University, because we see that the focus of this university is on practical capacity building, and his attention is on poor people, and with 34 LDCs in Africa, I think that we need to look at on what he's doing and to ask him. How can he improve or increase the number of African countries while the international community still is looking for answers how to build capacity in the LDCs? University like Earth University should be one that cater to our needs, and I think the UN system should look at Earth University as a practical example of institution that build capacity. I thank you.
Thank you very much for your comments and also for your question about how to proliferate the work of the Earth University elsewhere, especially in Africa. I have now China followed by the European Union.
感谢主席先生，也感谢今天三位演讲嘉宾。今天的演讲从不同的侧面、不同的深度，应该使我们大家进一步的了解了，特别是气候变化方面技术转移的这个有关的一些信息。我感觉到这样的这种交流应该是非常有意义的，这也说明这种交流是非常必要的。那么，由于我们关注的这个重点呢，应该是 技术的开发、转移和传播的这个机制问题，所以我想就环境和气候变化方面给三位嘉宾呢提一个问题，就是从你们的工作经验来讲，你们认为目前的我们在环境和气候变化方面的这个技术的开发、技术的转移、 技术的传播推广方面还有哪些需要改进的？比如说，如何共享各种资金项目的立项信息？如何共享我们在这方面的成功的经验和案例？不同的项目之间的协调一致怎么来保证？以及我们的项目或者我们的资金的使用效果如何进行评估等等？谢谢。
Thank you very much for your questions. As the, at least for the time being, last speaker on my list, I have the European Union. Please.
Thank you. I would like to first, as was raised by the honorable representatives of Tunisia and Egypt, and also by China and Liberia, I think what the last day and a half or so has revealed somehow is that there is a myriad of initiatives, of programs, organizations, partnerships that deals with facilitation of technology somehow. And I think while I do not have an overview, and I'm not sure that this forum is the best way to provide that overview, I think to some extent at least we are keeping to the mandate of these dialogues, which set out as the methodology in order to reach agreement on a technology facilitation mechanisms, which is somehow what to do. Then, before we decide on how to solve the problem, so to speak, we need to understand what the problem is. And I think what has come out in these days is as per the resolution that led to these meetings, that we need to identify and address gaps throughout the full technology cycle, from research to development, demonstration, market formation, transfer, and diffusion. We also need to identify and address where appropriate fragmentation, synergies, areas of duplication, and opportunities for cooperation between existing mechanisms and processes. And while I'm at least not at a stage where I can say, well, now we know what's happening, let's go and design a mechanism, I think what we've heard the last day and a half is very different issues somehow raised, and also issues that might not all have the same solution. I think we have heard some issues that would maybe relate to some kind of intergovernmental body or a norm-setting dialogue process or somehow within the UN. I think that's some issues would be addressed there. There's another set of And that has been voiced very much today. I think we heard that there's 21 UN organizations that somehow are actively involved in this field. And there is a need for better coordination of UN initiatives within technology facilitation. We've also heard specific problems and heard about particular gaps the need to implement better in certain areas, etc. So I think we have very uneven levels of of addressing these problems. And I think somehow that's has been the purpose of the first two days, is to try to come to grasp with what do we know. And I think, must say at this point, I'm not sure that we really fully understand what is happening out there, and maybe we need to better map this area, as there was called for yesterday, I heard, by the WIPO representatives, a better mapping of the initiatives, so that we can make sure that as when we go to the doctor won't prescribe the medicine before we understand exactly what is the problem. And I'm afraid that we are mixing up various problems and believe somehow that there is a quick fix to any of these. We've seen in the report from the Secretary General, he talks about at least about 10 different options. So I think we might need to further advance our understanding of exactly where the overlap and the gaps are before we can effectively address these issues and come up with some kind of solution which will, in the long run, create the kind of sustainable development which we are all here to ensure. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That's, I think, precisely what we are here for, to understand better where we are and where possible gaps are. I would now like to give the floor to Australia, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Moderator. And since this is the first time Australia is taking the floor in this workshop, I'd like to convey Australia's thanks to the President of the General Assembly, the panelists, and both the distinguished moderators for their work and the discussions. I'd like to echo many of the some of the points that my colleague from the European Union has made in terms of the need to sort of to keep a to follow a sequence when we talk about the technology facilitation issue, to firstly look at the functions and the problems before we get to designing a solution. And it's a cliche in the UN, but often when we talk about our institutional reforms, we do say that that form should follow function. Often I think we fall into the trap of trying to prescribe institutional fixes for substantive or political issues, and I would like to stress that we need to first have a full grasp of the gaps and the areas of duplication in the technology system, which I think this workshop has been particularly helpful in providing us a better understanding of. As many colleagues around the room have mentioned today, we've all gained a better understanding of the existing institutions in terms of the technology system. Yesterday we heard about WIPO Green, today we heard about the CTCN. And there are a range of other institutions. We're also moving forward with the proposal on the LDC Technology Bank, which Australia is very supportive of. And this morning we've focused specifically our discussions on fragmentation. And fragmentation appears, from our perspective, as an issue when there are gaps or where there is duplication taking place. I want to pull out a few points that I heard today that stuck out. One of them there is that there is better room for information sharing between existing institutions, and that there is also a room for needs analyses in countries, particularly developing countries, on how to better enable the solutions to their technology needs and enable clean technology diffusion or development. Now, there's much focus on the other point that stood out there. There's also much focus on the transfer and diffusion, but the early stages of the technology cycle are particularly important, both in terms of research and development. And some panelists mentioned the need for looking at the environments that enable the development of that technology. We've also heard that there could be a role for a better mapping of the initiative, or needs across the globe in terms of technology. Now, those are all good to bear in mind as gaps or areas that we could work together on in enhancing. But the question which we should be posing is, what is the best way to address these? And many have talked about a global mechanism in addressing this. But I'd like to note from the latest Secretary General's report of last year, there were a range of options that were proposed, and I think one of the important purposes of this workshop is to get a better understanding of how those other options also would contribute to a more enhanced technology facilitation system. I've also taken some particular note of views from the panel on the floor that we'd need to carefully weigh up the feasibility and the costs and benefits of having an overarching mechanism, and also that we need to be careful not to create another layer of bureaucracy. If we did something like that, we wouldn't necessarily be achieving our end goal of enhancing the overall technology facilitation system, but it could actually end up impeding it. So I would like to draw those points out in particular, and if I could pose a question to the panel, it would be, what are particular areas where those existing technology mechanisms could cooperate better in enhancing their work and filling those gaps? This is a question in its own right, in parallel to the questions that others have posed about the need for a particular overarching mechanism. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your comment and your questions. I have India on the floor, and I would, and afterwards, unless there is an urgent need to take the floor, like to close the speakers list for this morning to give the panelists sufficient time to answer the questions which have been presented to them. So, India, please.
Thank you, Chair, and sincere apologies for taking the floor again, but I think just to take the advantage of your call for having an interactive debate and listening to each other, and we are all learning as we go forward. And I was listening very carefully to the response by the panelists, as also by other members in the room, and I couldn't help the temptation of kind of coming back with a few thoughts. Mr. Chair, there's a saying in my country, perhaps it's there in others also, that the answer you get depends upon the question you ask. So I guess sometimes it's an issue of framing, and I was listening carefully to my colleague from the European Union, and I entirely agree with him about there are various ways you can look at this. The idea of mapping, the idea of having an understanding of what is going on is undoubtedly extremely important. But I think to presume or to pretend that this is the first time we are having this discussion and that we are first time we have learned about CDCN or about CIF would be really to do a disservice to the discussions we have had, very intensive discussions we have had over the past 2 years. The two reports that are on the table by the SG, which, as we mentioned earlier, have been prepared using extensive inputs from various UN agencies, have done a fair amount of this mapping exercise, even though it may not be perfect, but the information definitely is there. Therefore, I think the questions I think that we framed today, perhaps the problem lies there. The question really is, in terms of the mandate of the resolution, as to what arrangements can we think of which will help us in identifying and addressing these gaps in fragmentation, which undoubtedly exist. I mean, the panelists have pointed that out very pointedly, that there is a large amount of work happening, but it's not necessarily coordinated. Second point, I just quickly to mention, I think what Mr. Yuka mentioned earlier about this multiple agencies and fragmentation being perhaps inevitable or even desirable, which is, I think, a very fair point. But I think just to take that debate forward, when it comes to the substance, we seem to feel that fragmentation is bad and everything needs to come together. We need to come out of silo approaches, which we are doing presently in the UN. But somehow when it comes to the means of doing those things, we seem to feel that fragmentation is good and let all agencies do their jobs. I think there is a slight tension there, which perhaps the panelists could elaborate a little bit more about, but certainly a thing that we particularly attach importance to. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much indeed. And with those questions, I would like to revert for a final round of answers to the panelists. I think it basically comes down to the question, well, first, how much fragmentation is there, and to the extent how much is maybe good or is it bad? Because, of course, the term fragmentation, as I read it, has a negative connotation, you know. The other side to it is also maybe decentralization, which may also be a way of better tailor-made solutions. So I think that's, I think, a question which would be interesting to ask the panelists, you know, centralization versus decentralization, to what extent is that useful in your perspectives? And then I think the other question related to the first one would be how you see from your perspectives this question about creating a new mechanism to, in respect to better coordination between existing ones and using synergies and information sharing to overcome certain gaps. I would like maybe to start at the left this time, Dr. Zhang, as the first panelist. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I think I heard a number of questions asking on the role of, for example, what the CIF or CTF can do to facilitate coordination, or if such a technology facilitation mechanism were created, how could we contribute? I think to start with, the reason that the CIF was created was actually to share knowledge, to pilot the scaled-up demonstration of investing in these technologies so that we can share lessons with UNFCCC, with the GCF, and with others. So in that connection, I think we are in a position to do that, to share our knowledge, as we're doing here, the information, the project implementation experiences. In fact, knowledge sharing is also a big mandate. Part of the mechanism that we are working in, that I didn't mention in my presentation, is this partnership forum that we're doing. Every 18 months, we invite all countries, not just CIF countries, but all developing countries to participate in a knowledge sharing forum. In fact, we're working on that right now. This year is going to be in Jamaica, Montego Bay in Jamaica, at the end of June. If you are interested, I think it's still not too late to get on our website and register. You can go there, and we have many, many sessions sharing knowledge and specifically related to CTF and NASREP. We have a session on geothermal. We have another session on mini-grid. These are specifically technology-focused sessions. And those are the things. We actually invited the speakers from outside our MDBs, and some of them are not even CIF countries, to share experience with us. So I think this is one thing that we can do and we can contribute. There was a specific question from Egypt whether CTF or CIF could support R&D. And the short answer, unfortunately, is no. That's not our mandate. We have not, and we will not, support R&D. There was also a question actually from the U.S., a specific question that I forgot to answer, a very quick one, in terms of country-drivenness and whether countries, when they propose their priorities, projects or technologies, do they come out of TNAs, for example? Basically, no, because there's a timing difference. The TNAs that you could refer to, especially the latest round, have been developed in more recent years. And most of the CTF investment plans in particular were developed in 2009 and 2010. In fact, a lot of these large countries, middle-income countries, did not participate in the TNA exercise in the previous round of TNAs. Having said that, I think the sectors and projects that we're supporting are consistent. I haven't read all the TNAs, although at the JEF I was the one working with UCA and UNEP and others to support the TNAs. And, but I think in terms of the sectors, the technologies we're supporting, they are consistent with the TNAs, the technologies needs assessments. And we would be very interested in looking at the
the outcome and the outputs of the new rounds of TNAs, especially for our SREP countries, since about 40 of them have just sent expressions of interest. I think that will be an interesting exercise. So I'll stop here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I would now like to hand over to Mr. Uusikainen to respond.
Thank you very much. Tunisia asked several questions, which at least I could address one. One is that how to address that particular part of the technology cycle, which seems not to be kind of supported by many agencies or international efforts, and that's the R&D. When I was attending Technology Executive Committee, they have actually been thinking about it, there has been discussion whether a kind of specific window should be enabled in some of the financial mechanisms of the either climate convention or elsewhere to enable a kind of concerted support for that kind of thing. So it is indeed the international scientific cooperation is important. And then, indeed, we had the example from the university level, which was great to hear, and that might give us some light. On Egypt, we're asking where are the missing links and what really needs to be done. I have to say that we are now in that infancy of our work that we still don't know what leads, what comes from these requests coming from developing countries. But I'm already seeing that definitely we have to be somehow able to bridge the link between technology ideas and their bringing them to the maturity and then to the finance. And that is a very interesting area to be. That means that our work is immediately linked to the needs of the financial mechanisms under the convention, like GEF, Green Fund, and Adaptation Fund, that what they need so that they can come up with their resources in order to make that final path, which is the deployment dissemination getting into markets. If a global technology facilitation mechanism would be endorsed by the UN, definitely we will be part of it. When it comes to our role there, we will attend and participate actively to its meetings. If it's a coherence building and information sharing, definitely this is very much. If it's coordination, indeed we come and coordinate. It is very interesting to hear that a LDC technology fund is getting ground here, and we of course need to closely coordinate with this kind of facility when that is coming into a operation. One notion to Liberia, it is interesting to notice that Liberia has nominated the Faulkner College of Science and Technology from the University of Liberia as their national designated focal point for technology. And that is very interesting that Africa is coming up with that level of interest and cooperation on technology, and definitely very well welcomed. China and EU had very large questions, and indeed we would I have a struggle to answer such a wide-ranged issues. But let me put finally one thing in front of you, that most of the funding for the developing countries are indeed driven by themselves. For example, Global Environmental Facility is financing 80% of its funds goes directly to developing country allocations. And that then means that there is 20% left for a global, so-called global set-aside. And technology cooperation, financing for technology development and cooperation under that kind of regime is then, of course, limited to that global set aside, whether it's for R&D or whether other issues which are of common interest, capacity building, technical advice, assistance, and so on. Because it's understandable everybody wants a concrete result in their own countries by a project, whether it's adaptation for mitigation or then, of course, it is competing issues on biodiversity, chemicals management, and so on. There is indeed a need for a look at whether there is a provision of that kind of financing or the provision in the now established Green Climate Fund for financing those global needs which everybody sees important but which are not totally country-specific. And one of these operations, of course, is the CTCN itself. At the moment, we are totally on the bilateral financing on the short term. We can manage and we are operating for a couple of years with that basic mobilization financing which we get. But on the long run, this kind of technology advice service which we have established by the parties definitely has to be long term and systematic, as well as if this is going to be enlarged, this kind of service to all the sectors of sustainable development as we are here talking. So indeed, this is something to be considered by the parties. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I give now the floor to the last panelist, Professor Gul. I think your question relates more to the whole R&D approach. I think, you know, to what extent from a university point of view we could improve the whole first cycle part of technology in with basic research and R&D. And the other question is, you know, once again, you know, how to kind of copy and proliferate what you are doing in Earth in other regions, you know, of the world. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll try to answer the second one first. And it relates to the delegate from Liberia that made the comment on how an institution like Earth can be established in other parts, especially in Africa. And I must tell you that in these events of seminars that we had with other universities, there was a lot of young professors that wanted to change the same university that established. And one thing we found out that it's extremely difficult to change established institutions because there is a tradition, it's difficult to move. And probably the best thing is to create a new institution with a totally new focus. And I think that establishing a new institution like Earth will trigger, well, I'm not saying that we are the perfect example, but with the lessons learned, that institution probably will help others to change. That has happened in Latin America, for example. And so I think that there are institutions, foundations, and even governments that would like to start a new institution, but they say it's very expensive. And somehow I feel that when we say education is expensive, it's a mistake, you know. It's the best investment we can make in human beings is education. Now, the other thing I'm kind of surprised to hear that there is no resources for research and development from the Climate Investment Fund. But that's what exactly is needed in the least developed countries, because there are other, by the funds that our countries have, is limited because we have still too many other things to take care of. And so we tend to leave for the last resources for research and development, and there is very little dedicated to research and development. So I think that strengthening academic institution research, especially in areas of what the ones that we're talking about of priority, should be, you know, one of the focus of the United Nations. And I think I'm the only one now here in this panel from a developing country. And frankly speaking, we have technologies that we can promote, disseminate. We have research that we can share, but we have never been able to access to any of the organizations that are here. And I'm being very frank that sometimes the delegations come to the capital city, but it's very difficult that they visit the areas, the field areas where we are working. So I think that there are better ways to reach out, to understand the processes and be supportive of institutions that are doing a good job. And I'm not saying that we need more economic resources. Is to share capacity of other technicians. But if there is fragmentation, probably there is a lot, because from my point of view, I didn't even know that these institutions existed. And if you look at the University of Costa Rica and others, probably they didn't know. So how can we make this possible? And I haven't heard much about education today, you know, frankly speaking. And I know I hear about efforts for sustainability, efforts here and there, but what about the human capacity to be able to carry on these changes? The other thing about sustainability is consumption. Also, there is a big demand for energy. Shouldn't we also consider that we are consuming at a way that is not sustainable for the future? And what are we doing in that respect? So it's a balance between sustainability, but also about the way we consume things and goods. 40%, just to talk about a product, of bananas are thrown away because they don't have the size that the market wants. They are perfect. There is nothing wrong with it. But we have, you know, created that image that if it's not that size, they won't buy it. So we throw away so much product. We spend so many, we put so much chemicals just to have a golden, spotless yellow fruit. So I think as we consider sustainability, we also consider the way we live, the way we consume, the way we eat, and probably we need to find the balance for a change to occur.
Thank you very much also for your comments. This brings us rather to the end of this morning session, and I once again would like to thank all participants, especially the panelists, for their contributions. I think this has been once again a very interactive dialogue, and I'm appreciative of that. It will continue this afternoon with the second session, focusing on arguments for a technology facilitation mechanism. What concrete reforms and actions have a chance to receive broad support? So we will go very clearly into the midst of the discussion. This will start promptly at 3 o'clock p.m. in this chamber. And with that, I wish you a very good appetite and a good lunchtime, and see you this afternoon. This meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you.